So this is talking with Margaret Burbidge on 14th April 1988 at Paris at the De Vaucouleurs meeting. And can you tell me when you first came into contact with radio astronomy? What was the first thing that you did?
The first thing was working with my former professor, Clive Gregory, who was director of the University of London Observatory. And I was a junior assistant there. And he was provided with a position by the radio astronomers of a strong radio source, and asked if we could take a photograph of that place where the error box was.
This was Ryle's group that gave it.
This was Ryle's group. And so we had by then got the 24-inch refractor, which was used for parallax and proper motion work. It had been reassembled after the end of World War II and was operating, and we were carrying on parallax observations, and with Clive Gregory's direction and myself assisting, we took a plate of the position of this radio source and examined it in the measuring microscope. We didn't see in the error box anything other than a fairly rich star field. Mm-hmm. However, we transmitted the data to the radio astronomy group, and we heard nothing more for several months. And then we received a message from the radio astronomy group with a different position that was not only well outside of the error box of the first position, but was indeed off
not
the
even
plate
on your
that
plate. This was Cygnus A. We haven't said that yet. This was Cygnus A.
Oh, this was Cygnus A.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
And did you take any others? Did you take Cass A,
no,
perhaps?
No, we only took Cygnus A. We were discouraged by the discrepancy that appeared to be in radio positions at the time. And Clive Gregory determined to find out why there was this discrepancy. And, of course, he taught spherical astronomy for decades. And the explanation turned out to be that in deriving the positions of radio sources from the lobes provided by the antennae, you needed to know the speed at which the object was transiting across.
Right.
And what had been fed into the calculations by the radio astronomers, they not being used to spherical astronomy, had been the solar rate, not the sidereal rate.
Right.
And this difference, well, 1 in 365.
Made several degrees.
So we never did take a, having intended to take a picture that might have shown Cygnus A, mm-hmm. we did not.
And then I think you said the sun was too close to do anything.
Yeah, it was months later. And
when you got the new position.
Cygnus was no longer in.
Right. So when was the next time you came into contact with radio astronomy? You and Jeffrey took up a position, well, I guess Jeffrey, to be more accurate, took up a position in the Cavendish in 53?
Yes.
Would that be?
Yes, in 53.
And so you must have then had some pretty close contact.
Yes, he was working with the group, and they were doing the 3C catalog at the time.
Well, 2C actually.
2C was it then?
The one that had all the problems,
yes.
was being observed.
Yeah, yeah.
At that time, but
they were arguing that the mechanism was plasma oscillation.
That's right.
From experience with the sun, and he was on the side of synchrotron radiation.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you directly involved yourself, or
no? I wasn't
involved. What kind of work were you doing at that time?
I had no paid job at that time, but I had a lot of spectroscopic data from McDonald Observatory, mm-hmm. on magnetic stars.
I see.
And, measuring and identifying lines and measuring intensities and deriving abundances.
Right, but were you attending, for instance, seminars in the? That the radio astronomy group would have?
Yeah, I would listen to them, but I wasn't...
What was your impression of the group at that time?
A very close-knit group, and they would keep things rather secret.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they were doing at the time counts of
That's right.
The what came to be called the log N, log S counts, but they kept their results very secret. Now they were very opposed to the steady state cosmology right. idea, and they were very anxious to disprove this. Mm. And the steady state cosmology predicted a certain fall off of as you go faint, and what the log N log S curve that they derived was instead of three halves, negative three halves, right. was negative three.
Right, much, much steeper, yes.
Yes, much steeper. And so they said this is absolute proof against the steady state theory.
But you knew nothing about this before. You may recall it was a Halley lecture that Ryle gave in 1955.
That's right.
Even though you were, Jeffrey was part of the cabinet and you were closely associated with, you knew nothing about this until the public announcement.
No. In fact, I rode up to to Oxford, wasn't it, where the Halley lecture
right.
was given.
Mm-hmm.
I rode in the van with the radio astronomers,
uh-huh.
and they were telling me, at that point, they were telling me.
This is really going to be a good talk there.
Jeffrey did not come. He was rather irritated by having been kept...
Left out of it, yeah.
Left out of all the discussions.
Did you go to the famous RAS meeting a few weeks later in which Ryle gave essentially the same talk? I just wonder if you had any recollections of that meeting.
No, but I do remember a meeting. I do remember when it became clear that the radio sources were distributed more or less isotropically. That meant that they had to be something very close to the sun or something very distant.
Right.
And
this is now probably going back to 51 or 52 when Ryle was arguing that they were radio stars.
Yes, yes.
And go on, what were you...
Well, it's part of my recollection is that there was a bitter argument. I think it was, held at somewhere in the University of London, a meeting, and...
Well, this is perhaps the one on dynamics of ionized media that was held at University College
London.
One. That was in 51, yes. And Gold
okay.
and Ryle, in the proceedings of this, there are some heated exchanges.
Yes.
And you,
which,
so you were at that
Gold,
meeting?
Well, listening to it,
mm-hmm,
yes.
Mm-hmm.
Not taking part, but listening.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cambridge astronomers' view was that the... that these objects were radio stars, and the possibility was raised by Gold, and that they might be extragalactic,
mm-hmm.
and this was ridiculed
by
Ryle and colleagues on the grounds that the energies would have to be so
mm-hmm.
large,
mm-hmm.
and incredibly large.
Yeah.
Yes, that was
Yeah, that was 1951.
That was before we spent our first two
right.
years in the United States, and then came back to the Cavendish, and they were accepted by them.
But now the first papers that I find in which you actually co-authored that are relevant to radio astronomy were to do with some of the famous radio sources, and this is in the period 1955 to 60. What was your motivation for doing these? I mean, were you trying to understand the source of the radio emission? Did you want to see why these galaxies were peculiar?
Yes.
How did you get into that?
Yes, because just a radio source by itself is not much good unless you have an optical observation to go along with it. And to get a distance, you need a redshift. And so the idea was to take what identifications that were coming out, some better identifications
right.
and reasonable positions, and in some nearer galaxies that had been identified. And we wanted to find out what it was that was peculiar about these
mm-hmm.
galaxies. And Jeffrey was also working out the energies, and the energies required both in the particles, high-energy particles, and in the magnetic field. And the fact that the minimum energy condition was when you had equipartition between the two modes, and you had to consider whether you had only electrons to provide the particle energies or whether there was a component of protons.
On the synchrotron.
On the synchrotron. Yes.
Right.
So this was really his work, and I was just a partner in that. When was it we took our first observations of radio galaxies? I guess it was after we got involved, of course, in the synthesis of the elements, and that took the whole of the second year that we spent in Cambridge, working with mainly with Willie Fowler and Fred Hoyle, and that our involvement in that started really through these spectra that I'd been analyzing of peculiar abundances in magnetic stars, and we needed to find out something about neutron capture processes, and we didn't know very much, and we went to Fowler for help, and that started the whole of the collaboration going between the four of us.
Now, of course, part of the motivation for doing that, was it not true, came out of Hoyle's desire to show that there was another way to make the heavy elements besides...
Well, his original, it's 1946, his famous paper of 1946, which where he showed how to make the iron peak elements in the interior of a star. And then he'd had time working with Fowler and Caltech, in which they'd gone further than just the iron peak elements, and they'd looked at lighter elements.
But I bring up the cosmology because I was interested in how you viewed at that time these source counts that you talked about with the steep slope that seemed to be quite inconsistent with the steady state idea. First of all, what was your general feeling about steady state versus an evolving universe? Yourself as an extragalactic astronomer.
Well, by then the scale of the universe had been expanded. The various errors in the original Hubble determination, and many of them had been removed, and so the time scale.
That problem had gone away. Yes.
So there wasn't the bad discrepancy between the age of the solar system and the age of the universe. So I don't think I particularly didn't have any strong leaning either way, although steady state appealed to me more philosophically than a Big Bang cosmology. We started when we went to University of Chicago and had access again to the McDonald telescope. We ceased at that point really to work on stellar spectra, which we'd been doing when we were at McDonald at Chicago before, and started to work on galaxies. We got interested in masses of galaxies from an early paper by Martin Schwarzschild in the Astronomical Journal of 1954.
I see.
I described in a journal club.
That's the original motivation for that long series of papers?
It started it, yes.
Right.
But so we had two things to do. One was we wanted to look into getting rotation curves in a more efficient way than just point by point, as Aller and people had pioneered, and also to work on the nature of the radio galaxies. And one of the objects we particularly wanted to study was Centaurus A, strong radio source. Was not even known at the time we started to work on it whether it was an external galaxy.
For sure, yeah.
There had been a suggestion in the literature that it was a weird kind of planetary nebula. Now it was at declination minus 43, which could be reached from McDonald with difficulty. So we tried. And that was where I had an accident on the telescope.
What was that accident?
Well, we tried first of all to get it at the Cassegrain focus with the Cassegrain spectrograph, and we had all the lights out.
Yes, you were.
We had the Cassegrain platform, therefore, right up and the telescope low, And the Cassegrain platform came up in two halves, and there was a gap in the middle. And to get the telescope spectrograph in, one took down, I had taken down the chains that guarded you from stepping down the hole.
Right.
The floor was high. I had all the lights out because it was difficult to see to set the slit on the right place on the galaxy. And in my excitement, I stepped down the hole. Luckily, it was winter time, and I was well padded up in warm clothes.
How many feet, roughly?
About 12 feet down onto a steel floor. And I must have fallen cat-like, because I didn't break any bones. I carried the control paddle with me that had the lights. But what I did do was knock all the wind out. It was like having a strong punch in the solar plexus. And I could not speak. I couldn't draw a breath to speak. And I could hear the night assistant and Jeff shouting down from the Cassegrain platform, "Are you all right? Are you all right?" And I couldn't answer. And they had no light because I'd carried the paddle down with me. And I heard them fumbling to get to the steps to climb down. And eventually I managed to draw a breath and said, "I'm all right." And then they came, picked me up, and I was all right, but bruised all over.
So this Centaurus A data took a lot of effort, you're saying.
We then went to the prime focus later on to get it, to do it properly. We decided we needed to go to the prime focus. And there, with the telescope in the same nearly horizontal position, one could lie on the roof of the Coudé room and get into almost any position angle of the spectrograph that you wanted. And so we did it that way, lying on the floor.
So what did you make of Sen A?
Well, then we got the rotation. We found that there was plenty of hydrogen gas in the emitting H-alpha in the dust lane. And so we were able to... We got a rather... a definite rotation, that dust lane was rotating. We made little attempt to do anything in the stellar component outside of the dust lane, because the spectrograph was set to reach at H-alpha. It had very poor resolution as you went to...
And
very poor transmission as you went to the region of the stellar lines, calcium H and K. So all we got was the rotation of the dust lane. And there were some irregularities in the rotation, suggesting what the dust itself looked to be suggesting, that it was a ragged, a very disturbed distribution.
Let me ask, we're running out of time a bit here, but let me ask more generally how you viewed the effect that these radio sources had on extragalactic astronomy. I mean, did they bring in a new universe, or did they just sort of modify the old one, or what did it do to the way astronomy developed through the 50s and then the early 60s, say, in the pre-quasar era?
Well, the main problem was, what was the energy source? And that was a big puzzle, because Jeff's earlier calculations had made it quite clear that a big energy release was needed. And one suggestion that had been made by Minkowski in the observations of NGC 1275, he'd found two sets of velocities
That's
in the
right.
gas differing by 3,000 kilometers a second. And he suggested that this energy could be provided by kinetic energy, simply collisional energy, kinetic energy, amplification by the collision of a pre-existing magnetic field, and acceleration in the magnetic field of charged particles. Our calculations showed that you couldn't get sufficient amplification by collision, so that would not work. And
What I was thinking is it a fair statement to say that radio astronomy was the means by which attention was drawn to the fact that that was not a quiet universe in terms of stars burning, galaxies.
Yes, it was rotating. The beginning of the era of the active universe, if you like.
Right, right. Although it wasn't clear that the nucleus really was the key, as we now think anyway.
Well, it was. It was.
Ambar Sumian, of course, was pushing for that, but I don't think that was a general feeling at that time.
It was our feeling from the our studies of NGC 1275, when we found that Minkowski's high-velocity filaments came into the nucleus, and the nucleus was a Seyfert nucleus, after all, it was one of the original Seyfert galaxies. And we suggested that it was material being ejected from the nucleus.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Virgo A, M87, also is highly evocative of this kind of thing. Yes. But what did you make of Cygnus A, where the emission was coming from?
Clearly there had been the ejection. And nobody realized that time how very narrow
had two blobs.
Had two blobs where high energy particles must have originated at the center of the galaxy.
Well, but that's a big jump to say that, isn't it? That they must have originated.
If you drew back the line, the galaxy was in the center.
Well, that's
at least
true.
They'd come from the galaxy, and the place where any activity from observations of nearer things like NGC 1275 was that there is activity in the nucleus.
So you're saying anyway that you and your husband were working on the model that the nucleus really was the key to how this developed.
Yes.
Right. I'd like to ask about the very beginning of the quasar era. Now, I think it's correct that you were not directly involved with the work the first few months at Caltech when the redshifts were identified and so forth.
No,
you got into it very quickly.
We still had some time at McDonald, and when I gave the Russell lecture, I decided to drag up this bit of history and reproduce some early spectra that we took at McDonald at the prime focus of the 82-inch telescope of 3C48. Mm-hmm. It was a good position of 3C48.
Just before the redshift was identified?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Yes. And I think I in the Russell lecture, I mentioned this is a 20/20 hindsight.
Yes.
And showed the spectra. And there were, you could actually see, right in the red end, H beta and the oxygen 3 lines.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But I only saw at the time, I only noticed one emission line, which I guess was the 5007 emission line.
Uh-huh.
And one would not have. Of course, we weren't looking in shorter wavelengths
to see
anything else.
But going back to the data, you can see it there,
Yes. So I do have that reproduction.
Well, what did you make of these stellar sources like 3C48 at that time?
Didn't have enough data. It was about the limit of what you could get at the McDonald prime focus, and it was hard to set on, hard to guide on.
So it really was almost confined to the 200-inch to.
Yes.
To do that kind
and of
course,
work. The position of 3C273 wasn't made generally public.
Well, that's right. Hazard wrote to.
We could have observed that.
Yeah, right.
But it was bright enough. But it was sent privately to Martin Schmidt by Cyril Hazard, who had made the identification. As soon as there became a reasonable number of identifications, and in 1962, when we went to Lick Observatory, went to University of California, and could use Lick Observatory, then I started working there at the prime focus of the 120-inch telescope, getting spectra of just mainly a collection of redshifts.
Mm-hmm.
That was the idea to start with.
Right, which led to a long program, which is beyond my. I'm sort of cutting my study off in the early 60s. One last question. Do you see any effects, and don't let me lead you in this question, if you say no is a perfectly good answer. Do you see any ways that radio astronomy, through this era, influenced the way optical astronomy was done, in its style or its content? Or was that...
Yes, well, it certainly it made one realize that something had to be done to improve methods of detection and spectrographs.
So you think that it pushed that along faster?
It pushed that along. It used to take me 5 hours sitting on one exposure in the prime focus cage of the 120-inch telescope. And, mm-hmm. Well, that doesn't compare with 10 days that Humason used to sit.
Right, it's a long time.
It still felt a long time.
Right. So in the desire to do spectroscopic work on these faint sources, that was a driving force, you're saying?
It was certainly a driving force at Lick Observatory, mm-hmm. with Joe Wampler to, mm-hmm. to
in
develop.
In the 60s, yeah.
Yeah. Well, he got his going in the early 70s.
And what about the aspect, by style, I mean the way that the radio astronomers were much more kind of thing of, let's put out a quick paper and you know, it's much more today's kind of science as, yeah. opposed to the traditional observatory where you have lots of unpublished data and you eventually put out a complete study.
Well, I used in those days to put out, as for our rotation curves, we used to put them out one by one as we got them.
Right.
I'd put out like a dozen redshifts in a, mm-hmm. paper. Whereas,
but did you feel yourself influenced at all by how things were doing in radio astronomy? It sounds that you didn't, that you don't feel like the way that was happening in radio astronomy was influencing how you were doing optical astronomy.
Well, it made me gradually switch from working on galaxies, although continuing a little bit, to spending time working on quasars and the discovery of the first absorption lines in the 1960s.
Right, but I was thinking more of the style of how you did things rather than the actual scientific content. In other words, in terms of...
Well, I was working with... Instead of working with nice bright stars and getting Coudet spectra that would take
yes, well,
forever
right.
to analyze,
right.
it was working with a little spectra, a half an inch or an inch.
It gave you
long.
The motivation to do this incredibly difficult work with very faint things,
yes.
which had only been brought to the fore because, yeah. of the radio.
And we had no TV guidance, of course. It was all setting on the spectrograph slit had to be done by eye, and I used to have ways of keeping... My eyes at that time were pretty good at seeing faint light sources.
Mm-hmm.
People used to laugh that I used to keep a black patch over my guiding eye if I had to get into any light to keep the dark adaptation of that eye. And I could set 19.5 magnitude at the prime focus of the 3-meter telescope. When remember, the sky was much less bright in those days.
Yes.
But that was my limit that I could, mm-hmm. set on.
That's damn good. Well, thank you very much.
That ends the interview with Margaret Burbidge on 14th April 1988.